When talking about Burgundian-style Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, Talbot Vineyards in Monterey County stands tops on the list. Talbot winemaker Dan Carlson may make the wines in the old world style, but their pricing is surprisingly new world. We spoke with Dan via telephone in late May of this year, the year of crazy spring weather in California. So I'm in the studio, and I'm here with Dan Carlson of Talbot Vineyards, who is not in the studio. He's on a telephone speaking to me from California. How you doing, Dan?
Doing fantastic.
Great. There's a lot of stuff to cover. You've been with Talbot for how long now?
About 2 years.
So you've been a winemaker for a heck of a long time.
Yeah, this will be my 30th vintage.
If you don't mind my asking, as an aside, how old are you?
I'm 56.
Wow, you do not sound 56. I would have put you in late 20s, early 30s.
A wine keeps you young.
That's good. I like that. That's a good motto for a winery.
Yeah, the TTV wouldn't like the health implications, but...
What do they know?
Exactly.
You've done a number of things. You were studying marine biology. You were basically in construction, various trades of that. You've done all kinds of stuff.
I have a pretty diverse background. I studied biology in college. I got a degree in biology. I was a real big beer brewer in college. I had no money. And so my wife and I set up a brewery in our home. And my brewing partner ended up getting a job as a maintenance mechanic for a winery. And that's how I actually got in the wine business, was through my friend. We built a wing at Dry Creek Vineyard in Healdsburg in 1981.
I'm just going to go back to the brewery real quick. When you say a brewery, I mean, this was not a commercial brewery, I assume, or
no,
was it?
No, it was just strictly home brewing for our insatiable desire for good beer.
Well, there you go. And you're certainly not the first winemaker I've talked to that started with brewing.
You know, I think brewing is a science, and it's kind of fun. Winemaking really isn't a science. It's more of a craft.
So really, you're working to an end that's, I don't know if I want to say predictable, but set.
Somewhat. Let me put it this way. I think that the end result of beer is set by the brewer. The end result of wine is set by the vineyard. It's very different. The raw material in wine, I think, is much more important overall.
Sure. In the long run, you're not as weather dependent, I would think.
Absolutely. And, of course, you make beer. You don't make wine. You produce wine. And so it's really a different philosophy.
There you go. You're a maintenance mechanic.
At Dry Creek Vineyard, yeah.
And you just made a very natural turn into winemaking.
First of all, I love the people. In those days, it was amazing we even had a wine industry. And I think we were mavericks and founders of an industry that today is conservative and well-established, but quite honestly, in those days, it was the Wild West. You know, Robert Mondavi was just really doing his thing and had done so much for our industry, and I think it really paved the way for a lot of us boutique guys.
And Dry Creek is quite an interesting history, and it's a great winery. I'm a big fan.
I worked for David Sayre, the founder, and I was at a tasting the other night and ran into his daughter, Kim, and it was just so fun to kind of come full circle, you know. They remember me as some sort of crazy hippie who crawled out of the hills and twisted bolts, and, you know, and I've spent the last 30 years running large and small wineries. So
whether it is directly family or not, there's still that sort of family connection.
Absolutely. I still have enormous respect and admiration for Dave Stair. So.
You were also at Domaine Carneros.
Correct. I went from Dry Creek Vineyard to Dellinger in Russian River, and I worked for Tom Dellinger in Russian River making mainly Pinot Noir and Chardonnay for about 4 years as his assistant. And, of course, Tom had five kids, so I didn't see I was going to inherit the winery. So when the Taittinger family came in and started building Domaine Carneros, I was actually hired when they were just pouring the foundations.
Of the building you're referring to?
Yeah, the chateau.
Right, yeah. I could have called it a chateau, but I went for big building. Thanks.
We call it the faux chateau.
The faux chateau. I could see that. I've driven by it a billion times. So what a contrast to go from the Dry Creek area into Carneros.
It was really fascinating. I think Dry Creek and then Russian River and then Carneros were all three so distinctively different. It was an amazing training ground in that I really saw how the vines responded differently to these three, you know, radically different regions. It was kind of fun, too, because, you know, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir has been a sort of a theme of my career. Most of my career I've spent making Pinot Noir, which is interesting, and Carneros was really a fascinating venture, not to mention dealing with the Taittingers and Cobrand Corporation, and just that much financial backing as well as the heart to make great wine. I really found the Taittinger family just had enormous passion to make fine quality, and so it was just fantastic to have those people behind you.
Which brings up another contrast, going from Dry Creek, and then you're working for a larger corporation. So you were comfortable in that situation.
Absolutely. You know, I don't really kowtow to anybody. I'm kind of a perfect winemaker in that I'm belligerent, I'm stubborn. I know how to make these people money, for example, and you make it through great wine. And when you produce these great wines, they all back up. It's kind of fun. They push it first, and then you say, listen, I'm going to make your lives easy. We're going to make a beautiful wine, and everybody relaxes.
But you're also making sparkling wine then.
At the time, you know, the sparkling wine is a grueling endeavor. It's a real science. It's kind of like beer brewing. You know, you have to get it right. A still wine is sort of a little more lackadaisical.
I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that before.
Still wine is a craft. Sparkling wine is a science also.
That's interesting.
When I came to Talbot, somebody said to me, well, you have Sleepy Hollow Vineyard, you have this beautiful Chardonnay Pinot Noir site, why wouldn't you make bubbly? Because I'm not insane. It's an enormous amount of work, and it requires a real special mind. I find still wine more of a retirement plan. I love it. You come to work every day just with a smile on your face, and the craft of winemaking here is just really exciting.
This may be an ignorant question, so forgive me for it. When you're making still wine versus sparkling wine, are you being pulled different directions a bit?
Absolutely. Sparkling wine is about a very specific flavor of neutrality. It's kind of a funny thing to say, but in still wine, you're looking for horsepower. You're looking for power of flavor, et cetera. In sparkling wine, you're looking for neutrality of flavor because the bubbles themselves, the carbonation, is like a magnifying glass. They actually incredibly magnify all the aromas, et cetera. If you go into a sparkling wine with intense, ripe aroma, it's overpowering after you've carbonated it.
Interesting. That's a good description because I think a lot of our listeners put wine up on a pedestal.
Yeah.
And here's a very clear example of the two areas.
Yeah, years ago I asked Claude Taitinger, when I was working for Domaine Carneros, I had lunch one afternoon with Claude Taitinger, and I asked him, what's the mark of great champagne? And he looked at me and he said, when one glass invites another. And I thought, wow, that's the good life. You know, that we're making a beverage that people don't nitpick. They don't really talk about it, but when it's great, it just invites you to drink more and enjoy it more. And I used to say at the end of the day, you count the number of empty bottles, and that tells you how good you really are, you know?
That makes sense. What a great way of putting it. So then you went for a completely different territory.
Yeah. After 10 years with Taitinger, I mean, I'm a person that gets bored really easily. And so fortunately, about halfway through my career at Taitinger, they launched the red wine program. And so, you know, we started to make still red wine, Pinot Noir, and that really kind of rejuvenated my passion for that place. I was offered a position to run Estancia by Agustin Junaeus. I moved to Monterey to do that. I worked for Agustin for about a year. I have enormous respect for the man, but him and I are like oil and water. And so after about a year, I thought, you know, it's probably time to start thinking about doing something else. And I got a phone call from the Chalon Wine Group, and they said, how would you like to be the general manager winemaker for Chalon? And it was interesting. I interviewed for the job the day that Dick Graff was killed in a plane crash. So very, very strange to do that. But I walked into Chalon as GM winemaker, very historical estate, enormously linked to Burgundy and the concepts of Burgundy, meaning all limestone soils. And, of course, Dick Graff was, I think, one of the first guys to bring traditional Burgundian winemaking to California. So kind of fun to fill his shoes.
I can't even imagine. Just to backpedal quickly on Carneros, I'm assuming the Pinot was estate. Is that correct?
Yeah. It was really fun, actually. I mean, my first vintage there, Tony Soder, who owns Etude Winery, was buying a lot of Pinot Noir, and he was actually taking the best Pinot Noir from our property and making Etude from it. And so I called Claude Taitinger on the phone. And I said, you know, why are we letting this happen? Why don't we make red wine from it? And so he said, well, if you think you can do that. And I'm like, buddy, I've been at Dehlinger for 5 years. I think I can do this. So I called Tom Dehlinger on the phone, and I said, I want to borrow all your fermenters and your mush pumps and all your wine processing equipment, and what do you want to loan it to me? And he said, three cases of Lorev. So I drove three cases of Blanc de Blanc over to Tom Dehlinger, and we loaded all this equipment on my truck, and we drove it back to Domaine Carneros and made red wine. It was fun.
I got a big smile on my face. Is Napa this overwhelming gorilla on your back in terms of being a California winemaker, especially having been in Sonoma? Is it something that you just simply move forward and make the best wine you can? Is it something that weighs on you?
You know, it's really funny. It's kind of the opposite. I sort of feel sorry for these guys. They're in a fairly inferior grape-growing region. Most of the valley floor is bottomland, and the great grapes of Napa, of course, are coming out of Rutherford Bench or Stag's Leap. You know, the first thing you learn in the wine business is grapevines don't like wet feet, and I can guarantee you that most of the valley floor there is really inappropriate for grape-growing, and it's a tourist destination, and we really appreciate that. at Talbot, we don't have a French restaurant in town, but we've got an amazing vineyard site, incredible drainage, gravelly, sandy soils, and perfect exposure and climate. So it's kind of funny from a Burgundian perspective. I don't really envy Napa other than their tasting rooms are very profitable.
Sure, I understand that.
And, of course, you have to have heart, you know, for your own place. And well, it's funny. I was in Napa about 2 months ago, and I was buying a piece of equipment. And I was traveling around with an equipment salesman, and I said, so, you ever drop in and talk to this guy or that guy? And he goes, you know, Dan, all the Napa winemakers are so busy curing cancer, they don't have time for us.
Interesting.
I believe very, very strongly that you are not going to find a better vineyard site in the world. And I'd love to have you come here, and I'll show you why.
Well, I hope I can.
You know, great drainage is really the key. Actually, you know, there's only three flavors in a grape. There's underripe, ripe, and overripe. And they exist in a bell-shaped curve. And the compression of that bell-shaped curve, meaning homogeneity of ripeness, is actually the mark of a great vineyard. And this good drainage, identical exposure to the sun across the entire vineyard, lends itself to enormous homogeneity. And that's the real screw turner of sort of the primordial hunter-gatherer mind.
The Diamond Tea and the Sleepy Hollow are relatively close to each other. They're not hours apart.
Yeah, they're about, by car, maybe 20 minutes apart, but they're radically different. Diamond Tea has no soil. It's on solid rock. And you're overlooking the ocean, so it's incredibly windswept, incredibly cold site. You really make wines that I would think are more old world than new world. Sleepy Hollow is a much more California site. It's a little bit warmer, less intense, and produces rounder, more voluptuous wines. Diamond Tea produces more angular, tighter wines.
And the Diamond Tea is literally right on the coast.
Yeah, you look right down the ocean. It's Rob Talbot's home, and it's one of the first vineyards he developed personally.
I promise I'm going to get there one day.
I'd love to have you come taste the barrels and such, because the wines here are just so across the board, I'm going to say easy to make. It's a vineyard site that just wants to be wine. And so as a winemaker, I'm finding this like the easiest job I've ever had, because the vineyard is so powerful.
So primarily Chardonnay, Pinot Noir. And
yeah, only Chardonnay. Well, we do a little late harvest Riesling, and that's the only exception.
Okay. And obviously your focus is definitely old world, and I understand that because of the climate.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is Burgundy country. We don't do good Cabernet here. And again, I'll get a phone call later about this, but Monterey County is not Cabernet country. It's too cold at night. Cabernet is like a pot roast. You have to roast it for a very long time, and it needs a lot of heat. Pinot Noir is more like a flank steak. You can kind of flash fry it and you're done. And if it cools down at night, Cabernet always retains a vegetal character. So we're learning a lot of lessons down here of what's appropriate.
And you guys actually have a tasting room there?
We don't, but we're just getting ready to open one at the winery. We have a remote tasting room in Carmel Valley Village.
In terms of somebody who would want to visit that area, from what the impression I've gotten, that the wineries are a bit more of a distance away from each other.
You know, we're not only a distance away from each other, but there's also no infrastructure. I mean, there's no bed and breakfast. This is hardcore farming, and this is a farming community. I mean, we're in the Salinas Valley. And what's really fun about Salinas is that grapes are like the number five crop. You know, the number one crop is head lettuce and broccoli and cauliflower, et cetera. But what's really interesting about Monterey is it so resembles Burgundy in that the valley floor is all vegetables, and the bench lands are all grapes. And the mountaintops are all wilderness. And that's the appropriate way things should be. In other words, the bottom land is not capable of producing world-class grapes. There's too much water. And the bench lands are what makes the great grapes. But here, rather than having tourism, we have agriculture.
Which brings me to the tourism question. Do you see that as an area that will develop more because of the popularity of wine, will develop into tourism?
You know, we hope so. And I think also what's really fun for what we're doing here, for example, Sleepy Hollow Vineyard is about 550 acres planted.
That's huge.
I don't think you could find a vineyard in Napa that was 550 acres.
No, that's gigantic.
So this is a gigantic vineyard that we oversee the production. I mean, we're making about very close to 100,000 cases a year of our total production, 100% from Sleepy Hollow Vineyard and Diamond Tea. So we're performing our job at a level that I don't think the boys in Napa would be ready for.
No, that's more like your old neighbor's Gunlock Bunchu almost, isn't it?
We're doing the real thing here, and we control every grape that comes into the winery and everything bottled under our roof. So we're 100% estate grown on every wine that we make, and 100% family owned by Rob Talbot. And of course, I don't know if you know Rob, but he's one of the most generous, kindest human beings on the planet, you know. So I think I got the best job in the wine business, quite honestly. It would kind of shock you because, you know, Monterey County, and again, not to talk about Santa Lucia Highlands, but Monterey County, we've got about, I believe it's pushing 70,000 acres of grapes.
Wow.
Napa is about 20,000 acres. So, you know, it's interesting. 80% of the grapes of Monterey County never receive an appellation of Monterey. They're used to pad blends all over the United States.
That's interesting. You were talking about the water. California has had unique weather, to say the least, at least in this season. I was in San Francisco very recently, and the weather was just quite simply awful with rain, more rain than I would have ever expected. So how's that affecting you guys down there?
Well, we're thrilled. You know, we filled all of our reservoirs down here. The water table in our soil moisture content is full. And I think that we've been really hurting for water for about 4 years here. So we're very happy to see it.
So are you less susceptible to rot because of the climate?
San Lucia Highlands is a very temperate, cool climate. So we actually have probably more mildew issues than most. You know, mildew is killed above 95 degrees. So if you have a real hot day, you're completely protected from mildew for probably 3 weeks. We do not have that luxury in the San Lucia Highlands. It's a very cool climate. We're driven by the proximity to Monterey Bay, which is, you know, one of the deepest parts of the ocean, period. There's a two-mile-deep Grand Canyon right in the middle of Monterey Bay, which holds the temperature extremely cold. So our proximity to that body of water is actually what determines what varietal will be the most successful.
So I'm interviewing you here in May, spring. What's your average temperature right about now?
Well, this year, we just have never gotten into the 80s. It's just been a very cold year. These storm fronts keep getting blown over us. I think Napa and Sonoma are probably in more trouble than we are for two reasons. Number one, if you look at a lot of Napa, it's very heavy clay, as is Carneros. You get rain into that stuff, it won't dry out. And so you start to build humidity under your canopy that will really fuel rot. Here, we have a lot of wind, and we have very sandy soils. So we recover from a rainstorm much more quickly.
Yeah, I'm trying to get this mental picture of the place. How totally different. Interesting. And I wasn't aware that the water was that deep, but obviously that makes sense how it would control the climate that way.
You know, it's kind of funny. You'll hear people in California once in a while say, oh, I'm completely dry farmed. Well, when somebody says they're dry farmed in California, that means they have a horrible vineyard site because we don't get rainfall 7 months out of the year. Any piece of property that could sustain vine growth in the middle of August or September in California is probably a peat bog.
Wow.
Not to rain on people's parade, but dry farming has become a marketing term that in California is impossible in a fine vineyard site because you're in a well-drained soil, you're above the water table, and August, September, if you're not watering, you're going to die.
Well, wouldn't you agree with me, especially going back to what we were talking about before, that there's a lot of marketing terms that are working with wines these days that are helping sell them too, you know?
Unbelievable. You know, I like to believe that we could tell the truth that it's even more exciting.
Does that frustrate you as a winemaker then?
It does. It does. And when people start talking about biodynamic and unfiltered and, you know, organic farming and all this, I appreciate that we're trying to have less impact on our environment. And, of course, we own this vineyard. This is Rob Talbot's children's legacy, and we're not doing anything here that we feel would impact the health of our property. But I don't really want to get wrapped up in fantasizing about winemaking issues, you know what I mean, as like wild yeast. And if people think that filtration hurts wine, that's just complete voodoo. Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of interesting. You never hear somebody in Burgundy say, well, the reason I'm better than my neighbor is because I'm wild yeast. What they say is, I'm better than my neighbor because I'm classified as Grand Cru.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the classification of wine becomes site-driven, not clonal, not yeast, not what barrel you happen to be using, or whether you're doing cold soak or not. It's really about, you got a piece of ground that's capable of producing world-class wine. And this is why I work so hard keeping our focus on our vineyard and not our winemaking. Winemaking is to follow the tradition of that varietal. And I trust the genetics of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. In a great site, they will make great wine.
We have our AVAs here in the United States, obviously, but do you feel that there should be that kind of a similar classification system that there is in Europe and the States?
Well, you know, the classification system fuels sales and marketing as well. And so to separate winemaking from sales and marketing is important in the first place. I mean, in other words, if I can claim to be Russian River, as an example, and my sales double because I claim that, well, you're probably going to claim it. I don't think any American winemaker would ever accept the level of control that the Appalachians have in Europe. I think we're much more independent and more maverick, you know, so to speak. When I worked for Taittinger, they were always kind of surprised how, you know, Americans think out of the box compared to Europeans, I think, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to hear. That was a very good answer. Thank you.
Well, you know, at one time the winemaker at Taittinger said to me, so who tells you when to pick the grapes? And I said, well, you know, we test them in the lab and we walk the vineyard every day, and then when they're ripe, we pick them. And he goes, oh, I know that, but who tells you to? I don't know. We walk the vineyard every day, we test it in the lab, and then we decide to pick. And he says, well, what keeps you from picking less ripe? And I said, because you won't make a wine that's competitive. And he looked at me as like, are you talking capitalism? You know, and I kind of looked at him like, wow, he didn't realize it, but I'm an American. I was brought up in capitalism. We're here to compete. I believe very strongly that we can make wines that can compete with any winery in the world. And that's part of my persona, I think, is an American competitive spirit that says, you know, I want to make the greatest wine in the world, and I'll go head-to-head with anybody.
Excellent answer. And that's going to bring me to my next question then. I buy a lot of wine, and when I go into stores, more and more labels are popping up all the time, whether they're from Napa, Monterey, Lodi, wherever.
Yeah.
And there is a certain amount of education out there, and as you say, a lot of phrases and catchwords that get people's attention. But where do you see this going now that wine is so popular, with so many labels?
I think we have a problem right now with a lot of huge corporate entities inventing and purchasing labels. And we end up with wines that say things on the label that make you think it's one thing, but it's not. And if I was going to say anything, I would love to see the consumer understand more about the legal labeling requirements. You know, for example, if the bottle says vinted and bottled by, or it says cellared and bottled by, that means the wine was not made by that producer. It has to say produced and bottled by. And I think that we need more education, because I'll say this, the TTB, which is the federal branch of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, is working their butts off to protect the consumer. And I'm very proud of that organization. As an owner of the federal government, you know, they are trying to make sure that all this verbiage that we put on the bottle does not lie to the consumer. And so I think the consumer should be educated a little bit more about what all the legal requirements are so they can actually pick up a bottle of wine and say, I know what this means.
You know, you're the first person who's really talked about that at all.
Yeah, and of course, the highest legal designation for wine in the United States would be estate grown. It means you must control, own, and produce every grape 100% that goes into that bottle. And what's fun about Talbot, every one of our wines is 100% estate grown. So we conform to actually the highest legal challenge, I guess you could say, for labeling.
What is the output at Talbot?
Total production here is about 90,000 cases, of which the bulk of it is our Cayley Hart brand. Talbot Cayley Hart and Talbot Logan are both wines that are selling for under $30. The Cayley Hart line is under $20, Logan line under $30, and then, of course, our Sleepy Hollow and our cuvées go up to $75 a bottle. It's kind of fun. If you look at the Cayley Hart as an example, one of the things that we did last year, we went to what's called the Eco Bottle. It's an ultra-light glass bottle. And every truckload of wine that leaves Talbot weighs 6 tons less. And you can imagine what that means in the distribution chain, not to mention just the amount of propane required to melt the glass. So what we're finding is the glass is so lightweight, we're saving so much energy that we save money buying the glass. And so we've looked at our lowest-end wines, our Cayley Hart, which, quite honestly, it's interesting. Our least expensive wines are actually my favorites because I like really fruity wine. But we're really looking at, rather than playing biodynamic and organic, we're saying, wow, with one phone call, we've decreased our carbon footprint by 50%. It's just unbelievable. And meanwhile, I think there's a lot of wineries promoting really heavy bottles as being a marketing gimmick. And I don't think the consumer understands how these heavy bottles are impacting our environment. So, you know, I think a lot of the things that we've done with the Cayley Hart line has reduced our cost of goods, but at the same time, we've transferred that savings to the consumer so that they can purchase a wine that's 100% estate grown by Talbot, has the Talbot name on it, and yet they're not going to be paying $30 a bottle.
Dan, you have some great opinions. I think the thing with the big bottles is it's sex appeal. People think the bigger bottles are sexy.
We call that Bar Fight Magazine Bottle of the Year.
You know, my damn problem is I can't get them in my chiller.
It's funny that we've created a marketing angle, the heavy bottle, that is so expensive, that is so impacting our environment. And it's a charming concept, but, you know, we're going to have to do the right thing. And I think it's really funny. When I went to the ultralight bottle, our marketing people all said, oh my God, you're bucking the trend. We're going to lose sales, et cetera. And my answer to them was, I don't really care. We're going to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. And that's going to be the Talbot motto, I guess you could say.
Well, it's a smart thing to do because also in the long run, you save money and it's practical.
Exactly. I think what's really fun about Talbot, for me, is that the story is so pure. We grow every grape, we make all the wine here in our own facility, and we're owned by a family. I think as wineries have less clear of a story, meaning they're bought by large corporations, they're purchasing 90% of their fruit, they're making wine at satellite facilities, their story starts to fade, so they start to make sure nobody knows what the bottle means, if you know what I'm driving at.
Yes.
When I have a pure story, I have no problem telling people, here's the truth, this is what the bottle means. I think when you're trying to sell something that's maybe a little more smoke and mirrors, you don't really want the consumer to know.
That's very interesting. It's a good way to put it. The other thing, the family aspect is a big deal. Some time ago, talking to other winemakers, they talked about the idea, well, some of the families are starting to go away because of larger companies coming in. But I've seen a lot of boutique companies popping up that are just that. Family wineries. Are you seeing that in your area too?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the pendulum is always swinging. We went through an enormous amount of consolidation and corporatization, and I think for the first time we're seeing a lot of the big boys saying, we're going to sell some of our brands off. We're going to try to get out of the fray, so to speak. And I think it leaves the door open for another group of small boutique guys to come in and try to see what we can do.
Do you think with a large company, major corporation, selling off some of their brands, that it's possible people with some financial background, but not a corporation, a family, could go into buying a label like that and revitalize it, bring it back? I mean, is that a practical thought or just simply starting from stones and basic?
You know, it's a thought I think that a lot of us in the business would love to see. Right now, I mean, not to get into business, but banks don't want to loan money on wineries right now. So it's very difficult for investors to come in and get backing from a bank. And, you know, the old saying that if you want to make $1 million in the wine business, you better start with $10 million is pretty appropriate. This is an enormously capital-intensive business. So it's very difficult for some passionate person to say, God, I really want to revive this winery that's been dragged through the gutter by some of the big boys.
Yeah, it's interesting to see, and I understand that from the banking point of view, sure. It's a crazy time.
Yeah.
Totally changing the subject. I've asked every winemaker, every owner, everybody I've talked to, how do you feel about screw caps versus corks?
Well, I'm a screw cap advocate, and we probably got to get back to the basics. And first of all, I'm just going to say that Talbot is 100% natural cork because Rob Talbot loves the aesthetics of the cork. But I'll say this. I think next year our goal is to take all of our high-end wines, the wines that are $50 and above, and put them all to screw cap. For Kaylee Hart and the less expensive wines, we feel there's a value added with the cork because I think the novice wine consumer loves the pop and they love the aesthetics of the antique closure. But for the connoisseur who wants to have a bottle of wine and wants it guaranteed, a screw cap is the best way to go. Let me put it that way. I'll also say this. There's a lot of myth, I'll call it wives' tale, that a small amount of air seeps through the cork and that creates the aging of fine wine. That's complete nonsense. It's been proven to be nonsense for 60 years, the first research done in the 40s on this. The aging of Cabernet Sauvignon is not oxidative at all. It's reductive. And the tighter you seal the bottle, the higher levels of bottle bouquet you'll end up with in the end.
Thank you for putting that out there. Cool. Good answer.
Let me say one last thing. The screw cap is an engineered closure that's testable. In other words, it's got an engineering to it that says when it's screwed on, it must have this diameter, it must be able to withstand this much pressure, and we can develop lab tests to test the efficacy of that closure. With cork, you really can't test it. You just keep your fingers crossed. At Talbot, we just buy the best quality cork we can, and that's the best you can do. The cork companies have gone through enormous effort in the last 5 years to improve their product, and I think they've been very successful at it. And I think there's going to be a counter argument, which will be that it's a natural forest, it's a natural ecosystem, it's a biodegradable product, and they're growing more of it, and it helps the planet. The aluminum screw cap is going to have a harder time arguing that. So I think that as the cork manufacturers clean up their act, work harder at eliminating TCA taint, et cetera, they're going to have a real viable product to compare to screw cap.
And that makes good sense. Yeah, I could see what you mean in terms of it being biodegradable. Dan, have you seen the glass enclosure?
I have. Not to digress, but, you know, you cannot control the interior of a bottle. It's an inflated product. And so the only part of a bottle you can actually control the dimensions of is the exterior, not the interior. So this glass closure has had some enormously tough growth pains, I think, because the interior bore is almost impossible to control. And so they're trying to create a glass closure that inserts into the interior of a bottle. I know people that have been using it for a number of years, and they say some of them just drop right in, and others you got to force them in, which shows to me an enormous amount of variability from bottle to bottle. It's a really neat idea. The glass closure is fairly inexpensive, even though you have to buy the appropriate bottle to go with it, and that's where your expenses come in. But I think what we're trying to do is create an inferior closure that is aesthetically better. And if I was to talk about screw cap, it's aesthetically our worst closure, and yet it's probably from an efficacy point of view the best. You know what I mean?
Yep, I know exactly what you mean. The glass enclosure was fascinating to me. I was also told by one of the winemakers in Sonoma that their big issue was they simply pop out of the bottle on the bottling line. So they're work intensive.
They're very easy to remove. And the people that I know that use them, I've warned them that I think you're making a mistake. That's my own opinion. And quite honestly, I would imagine in the world of wine, there's been probably more gallons of wine bottled with screw cap than cork. If you know what I mean.
I guess that speaks for itself.
So it's a pretty proven closure.
Where could our listeners find Talbot Wine?
Well, just about anywhere. I mean, we're pretty well distributed all over the United States. And you'll see our Talbot Cayley Hart or Talbot Logan as being wines that are fairly affordable. You'll see our top-end cuvées available really only through the winery or tasting room or wine club. But the Talbot Cayley Hart and the Talbot Logan you'll find at your local wine shop.
Dan, thanks very much for taking the time and being on the phone with us from California.
Well, thanks for having me.